Welcome to the Disney Parks Podcast with your hosts, Tony Castelnova from DisneyByTheNumbers.com and Krista Joy from DisneyWays.com. Keep your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the podcast at all times and get ready for the Disney Parks Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. We are so excited today to bring you Bill Cotter. Bill Cotter has been an avid scholar and fan of World's Fairs since his first visit to the 1964-65 New York World's Fair. His collection of vintage photographs has been featured in numerous books, including three previous titles for Arcadia Publishing, as well as several magazine articles that he's written, documentaries, and a website that also documents the histories of the fairs. And you can find more about him at BillCotter.com. Bill, welcome to the show.
Welcome, Bill. Let's start with It's a Small World. Can you tell us a little bit about It's a Small World attraction at the World's Fair?
Since I've been on Small World at one of the Disney parks, the Small World at Florida was picked up and brought to California after the fair using the same boats and trough and the dolls. It was just expanded out here. But it was a wonderful attraction, still is. You sit in the boat and you see the Children of the World singing, and I don't know. Should we mention the Sherman Brothers song? Because it will instantly pop into people's heads and get totally sucked in for the rest of the show.
Sure, that's fine.
They originally were going to have them sing the national anthem. So when you went through the UK exhibit, or a portion of the exhibit, the children would all be singing a song about the United Kingdom. You go into France and they'd be singing a song about France. And they found that when they tried mocking it up and walking through the thing, that the sound from one song bled too much into the next song, and it just, as Richard Sherman said, it became a cacophony of noise. So they were given the task of coming up with one unifying theme that you could hear throughout the exhibit, and they would add in then local little nuances and sound effects from each of the countries. But there was it's just an amazing song that they put together. You know, I tell people I've been so fortunate with my career working for Disney and other studios. But one of my highlights was the Sherman Brothers coming over to my house one night and doing a song fest at a party, playing my daughter's keyboard. And, you know, to have 50, 60 people sitting in the living room singing, you know, It's a Small World. Never as a 12-year-old kid at the fair could I even dream and hope for experiences like that.
Wow, that is fascinating.
Now, it was really, really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was reading that not all the dolls were made by the Disney company at that time. They were made by a company in New York. Is that true?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't have the details of that. I mean, a lot of the dolls or the audio animatronic figures today are made elsewhere.
Right.
I don't know about the Pepsi dolls. If that's true, it could well be. I just have never seen that particular reference myself.
Yeah, okay. The other pavilion, I guess, was something called Progress Land, or what we would maybe call the Carousel of Progress today. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was a real interesting one. Walt originally, in the late 50s, had the idea for expanding Disneyland to a new section called Edison Square. And they went all the way out to announce it. They put out publicity pictures and everything. It was going to be basically sort of where, with the cast parking lot, but sort of in the section where Space Mountain is now. And they just, again, couldn't convince anybody else to fund it. So they put the idea off to the side, and they pulled it out to the World's Fair and went to GE and said, you know, we have this great idea about this. It was originally going to be a walkthrough show where you'd walk into something, see the dawn of electricity and the beginning of electric lights coming into American cities and take you up to today. And they kept going through it, and it was going to be basically an educational show, but not real entertaining. And pretty big, too, walking through it. And somebody hit upon the idea of the Carousel of Progress, do the same show, but this time introduce a theater element into it and make it more of an entertainment show than an educational show. And luckily, the guys at GE liked the presentation and agreed to do it.
Yeah, yes. It's interesting that that's the song in there is also another Sherman Brothers song.
Yeah, that was there's a great big beautiful tomorrow. And they sang that at the World's Fair, and then they moved out here to California, and they had a great big Beautiful Tomorrow. And then years later, they decided to move it back to the East Coast and bring it to Disney World. And funny story with that, they had to do a new song because GE wanted to do something different, not just move the show. So they came up with a new theme song, Now is the Best Time of Your Life. And it was strange, you know, when I went back to Disney when I was working there to go there and see the Carousel of Progress with, quote, the wrong song, unquote. Well, a number of years later, they decided to re-bring the carousel back full circle, no pun intended, but they put back It's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow. And I was out to dinner with the Shermans, and they were saying that they had just run into some lady who was very, very mad because they had changed the music in the carousel. And they said, well, what do you mean? We put it back the way it was. And she goes, no, you took out that wonderful song, you know, Now is the Best Time of Your Life, which the Shermans said they hated, and you put in this other one. I don't know where you got the other one from. And they couldn't convince her that that had been the original because she had never seen it performed. It's just, I guess, whatever you see first, that's, you know, the original one to you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, the other weird thing I read about this pavilion, I guess, at the time was that there was an exhibit that demonstrated a plasma explosion of nuclear fusion.
Nuclear, yeah. What they had, the whole pavilion was called Progress Land, as you mentioned before. And the Carousel of Progress was the portion that, you know, you can still see today at Disney World. You came out of the carousel. You took an escalator upstairs, and it was a place called Medallion City. And you could see the latest GE appliances and all sorts of examples of, you know, modern kitchen stuff or jet engines, basically everything GE made. And then you went back down, and there was a fusion generator where they would crank it up, and this tremendous bright flash would go off, and the displays would tell you how many you know, megawatts or whatever of electricity they had just generated. So a lot of people thought it was a nuclear reactor, which I guess is you know, a lot more dangerous than a fusion reactor. But there was big hope back in the 60s that they could take this fusion technology and generate clean power from it. And it turned out the technology they were using actually used more power than it put out, so it never came to be a commercial success.
Wow. Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, fun to watch, though, and louder than hell.
Yeah, I was reading that it could be heard in the Travelers Insurance Pavilion next door. That's how loud this crack was.
Oh, my goodness.
No, it wasn't really that bad because it's funny how these stories come out because people talk about that.
Right.
If it was that loud, you'd hear it so much, you know, in the rest of the pavilion, it would have ruined the show element for the Carousel of Progress. So it was loud, but they did a pretty good job of containing it and you know, keeping it within that one particular area. If you also look, Travelers Insurance was all the way across the lake. It was a huge distance. There's frankly, I think even if you left the doors open and set it off, there's no way you would have heard it over at Travelers.
Wow.
I mean, there's another urban legend that something went wrong one day and a beam of light shot out of the GE, you know, pavilion, burned through the wall and bounced off the Unisphere. You know, again, great story. not so much for accuracy, though.
Well, I always say that if you don't have a good story, you can make one up. That's what the news does.
Oh, absolutely. I found, you know, in all the years working for Disney, people would come and, you know, they'd swear they had seen something happen, and you'd have to look at them and say, well, you know, I was there that day, and that didn't really happen. Oh, no, it did. You know, it's what was it, the Man of Shot Liberty Valance, there's some quote, you know, when the legend is better than the truth, print the legend.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, another story we love hearing about is the Ford's Magic Skyway. So we had Bob Gurr on the show and Raleigh Crump recently, and this is just so fascinating. So tell everybody about this pavilion.
Another one that morphed incredibly from the initial design. Disney had this wonderful idea of doing the 10 great wonder or natural wonders of the world, and it's actually kind of funny in the memo. They're saying, like, you know, get in a Ford car and see the natural wonders of the world, whatever they may be. And the first thought was you'd get in a Ford and you could see this pyramid, you could see the, you know, Eiffel Tower, you could see this sort of stuff. Then they thought, well, maybe we'll take it back to the United States. You could see the Grand Canyon. You could see, the Everglades or whatever. And people from Ford kept saying, but how's that going to sell cars? You know, what's the real interest in doing this? Because at first, they weren't going to have you go through a car. It was just going to be movies and other presentations. And Bob Gurr was one of the people that helped convince them that you could do this with cars. Because Ford had actually had a very successful demonstration back at the 1939 World's Fair, where people could come out, sit in a Ford, and they had a professional driver drive you around the a test track at the 39 World's Fair. And a lot of people back in '30s, didn't own their own cars, so getting a drive and being able to see how it worked was great. But Walt was convinced that he did not want people driving cars through there. He didn't want the exhaust smell in his pavilion, but he was mostly concerned that drivers wouldn't drive at the exact same speed, so they would hit the show elements at the wrong time. And with Bob's imagination and mechanical skills, he was able to come up with the mechanism to take the cars and self-propel them without having to have the engines running, and take people through the Grand Canyon, back a million years ago with the dinosaurs and stuff. So they kept this, some elements of it, but morphed it into just an incredible ride. It was one of my favorites as a kid. I had never been in a convertible before, and to sit there and pretend I was only 12, but pretend I was driving brand new Ford convertible, and the dinosaurs are roaring and everything. It was really a spectacular show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Still remains one of my favorites.
Yeah, I was reading that this was one of the two most popular pavilions or attractions at the fair at the time.
Yeah, GM was number one, and Ford was right behind it at number two.
Yeah. Bob, well, at the D23 Destination event, told some great stories about this attraction and about people getting sick on it, and then they had to clean them after before they went back out again. I just can't imagine, 50 Mustangs in a people mover type attraction. That would have been like so cool to get in one of these and do it.
Yeah, they learned a few interesting things about human beings as they did the show. I forget how many cars were on the line. They didn't have too many Mustangs. They added more as time went on because, the Mustang wasn't there for the opening of the fair. It was introduced a couple days into it. But one of the very first things they had thought would be a cute idea was to put a state license plate from each of these states on the cars. So they got real license plates, and they tried to get them to say, say New York 1964 or Philadelphia 1964. And it turned out to be a real mess because people would come along and they'd say, oh, I want to wait for the car from Oregon. And they would clog up the line because you'd have these people waiting for Oregon, these people waiting for Wyoming, these people waiting for Rhode Island. So they very quickly decided they needed to take the license plates off the car. Then when the Mustang came out, oh, boy, everybody wanted to ride in the Mustang. And they had to politely try to tell people, maybe your next trip, but right now you can get into the Comet or the Fairlane or, whatever other particular car came down the line. They also had an entire department when each night they would go through the cars and have to undo what everybody had done to them, that people thought it was really fun to pull off part of the radio buttons or the gear shifts, or it was amazing the damage that people did to them. So they had an entire department and a set of spare parts that they would just put the cars back together again every night.
Wow, that's crazy. Because I was going to ask, I guess the cars had the steering wheels and brakes and things like that. I can't imagine that the things they tried to do in these cars, left out their own device probably for 3 to 5 minutes.
Yeah, it was interesting because the cars got a lot of wear and tear. You can imagine millions of people sitting in the cars and going through it. And they had a 8-track player, or maybe it was 4-track, 8-track, some sort of player in the trunk that would do the narration. And it was fun because if you push the first button on the radio, you'd get it in English, and you could push the second button, it would switch over to French, and the third button would go into Spanish. And I rode that ride so many times. I remember one day we were bored, so we were just pushing the button, you know, to hear it go back to English or French or whatever. And one of the buttons, you know, you push the button on those old style mechanical radios, it just came popping right out, you know, onto my lap. And I was just terrified. Oh my God, you know, it just broken the force.
I broke
the
ride.
Out of this place. But, they would take the cars after the fair ended. They would sell them to Ford employees, and they would put the motors back in them, and they would put, for example, if you look at the cars during the fair, they didn't have things like side view mirrors or rear view mirrors because people would just get caught in those getting in and out of the cars. So they put the mirrors back on, put real radios in that. But imagine buying a used car and people say, how many miles does it have on it? And it says, oh, it has 4,000 miles, you know, but, you know, 6.5 million people rode in it.
That's
hopefully
crazy.
The seats were still working.
Yeah. Yeah. That's crazy. Now, this attraction became what we call the people mover of today.
Yeah. Not the one at Disney World, which uses a different sort of mechanism that uses a magnetic motor system, but with the rotating wheels, that was the people mover that we used to have at Disneyland until they unfortunately tore it out and took it away from us. But that's the same mechanism. The tires are in there and they catch a platen on the bottom of the vehicle and push it along at varying speeds.
Yeah, very cool.
Wow.
All right, so the last pavilion was the Illinois Pavilion, or however you want to say Illinois or Illinois, depending on where you're from. And this was the Great Moments with Lincoln. And I'm going to ask you this, Bill, because this is the first myth I always hear is when they were first testing this, I guess Lincoln sprung a leak and it looked like he was shot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the hydraulic figure, when you turn him off and he depressurizes, he basically just slumps over. They had the problem that not only did they slump over, but he sprung a leak in his chest area, and hydraulic fluid is reddish in nature, so it really looked like somebody just shot him and he fell over in his chair.
Oh God, that would have been fun to watch, but probably not if you're in the audience.
No, particularly with hot hydraulic fluid spraying in your direction.
Yeah, yeah.
They had a lot of trouble with Lincoln getting him ready for the fair because they were really pushing the envelope with the technology. I mean, having him move was amazing enough, but the fact that he actually stood up, that was just mind-boggling. And, you know, as they tell the story, because I would talk to, you know, guys that worked on it, he'd work great, you know, say 10 times in a row. And the 11th time, he'd start flailing and jumping and bouncing all over the place, and they couldn't figure out what it was. And they finally traced it down that the power supply coming into the building was not a pure enough voltage, rather. And so a spike would come by, and all of a sudden it would just throw off the whole mechanism. And you had to be careful working around him because the figure is a machine. And, you know, if the arm flings out at a major speed and hits you, you're going to get a hell of a wallop from it. And they were kind of worried about working near the thing when until they finally got it straightened out. So they traced it back. I think it was the electric and light power facility was testing their million power candlelight light. And when they fired that up, Mr. Lincoln would go into a frenzy. Then when they brought him out to California, they said, oh, we don't have to worry about it. No problem. You know, there's no power of light, you know, exhibit. But it turned out every time the monorail went by, it would throw Mr. Lincoln into a dizzy. So they had their challenges working out the electrical system.
Wow.
Man, that's a, I know they, well, I think Mr. Lincoln today is, I think what they call the A100. And he's got, you know, the state-of-the-art hydraulics. Well, I think they actually use air, if I'm not mistaken, now.
Yeah, they've really totally revamped the figure. I think if you look at, I think the first one that was really greatly improved was in the Great Movie Ride, the Wicked Witch. When I first saw what that figure could do, I was just blown away by the advances in AA figures. And they've really gotten so much better introducing them into the other figures and retrofitting some of those shows.
Yeah,
she's amazing. Every time I'm amazed by that figure too.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular, and I did see her mouth malfunction one day. So it happens to the best of them, but you know, it's pretty impressive when you consider how many cycles those things have gone through in their lifetime.
Yeah, it's amazing. So let's talk a little bit about the Tower of the Four Winds. So Walt wanted this to be seen from all over the fairgrounds, right? He wanted people to meet under the Tower of the Four Winds, right?
Yeah, it seemed like almost every company was coming up with a tower. I think you mentioned earlier you were at the D23 Rewind in November, and you know, I had fun trying to lead up to that by talking about towers, and you know, and then we'll talk about a tower that everybody remembers, and of course, everybody in the audience expects to be the Tower of the Four Winds, and you could come up with half a dozen other towers. But it was a great, concept. Tell everybody to meet me at the Tower of the Four Winds, or, the Coke Tower, or the 7-Up Tower, or, you could go on and on. But of all the towers, I absolutely love the Tower of the Four Winds. There's a pretty good breeze that goes through that part of New York, and with all the wind-powered mobiles and everything that were spinning around on it, I thought it was great. I'm so sad that it never made it back here to California with the rest of the ride.
Yeah. How popular were the Disney attractions compared to, say, all the other things at the World's Fair at that time, Bill?
About the only ones that beat them out were General Motors and the Vatican Pavilion, which had the Pieta there. Pretty much on top of that, Disney, I think, had like four of the top six attractions at the fair. They were really the undisputed king of the fair.
Wow.
Yeah. And is it true that originally the fair was supposed to be there just a really short time, and it got extended to like this unheard of amount of time?
No, the fair was always intended to be 2 years, and that's one of the things that got the fair into trouble. There's an organization in Paris that licenses World's Fairs, and they only want you to do 1 6-month run. And New York figured that there was no way they could build something of this size and pay for it in 6 months, because they also had to do amazing amounts of infrastructure to the city for highways and bridges and get people to go there. So it was always planned to run for 2 years. People tried to talk about maybe making it a third year, and by that time it was losing enough money, and the city wanted it done, and the exhibitors wanted it done. Some of them wanted to keep going because they wanted to try to sell off their stock of T-shirts or stuff. But the fair was always planned for a two-year cycle, 365 days spread over 2 years.
Wow, excellent. So,
it was a great time to be in New York, I'll tell you. It was
I can't even imagine. Yes. So, how did you get to go so often? Was your family just really loved it, or?
No, I tell you, I don't want to sound like I grew up in a poor cotton farm, but we didn't have much money to, provide for stuff like the fair. So my mother basically said I could go as often as I wanted with the conditions that I could find a way to pay for it, and that I could also bring my next brother in age with me and bring him home safely. And he wasn't any dummy. That realized that I'd have to end up paying for him too. So I spent quite a bit of time taking soda bottles and recycling them. I think within about a 10-mile radius of my house, you couldn't have found a spare soda bottle lying in the ground in New York for 2 years. I also had a friend whose sister worked at the Bell System, and she would be very good at sweet-talking the guards, batting her eyes and, you'd like to let my brother and his friends in. So that worked many, many a time, for which I was very, very grateful. So I also went with the Boy Scouts. They had part of the Boy Scouts would work as an honor patrol at the fair and, tell people don't step on the grass, exciting jobs like that, and I got to do that. So I went an awful lot over the 2 years, every chance I could get and that I could afford.
Yeah. So here's a crazy question, but what was the cost of admission back then?
It was $1 for kids and $2 for adults.
And once inside, did you have to buy tickets for the other pavilions or attractions, or
most things were free. There was, you know, some shows charged. Like they had an area called the Lake Amusement District, and most of the shows in there charged. The second year, Florida brought in a really well-received show with speedboats and water skiers. They also had dolphins. I think it was the first time people were seeing dolphins in a theme park. But most of the rest of the fair was free. I mean, there were some things like the New York State Pavilion to get up to the top of the tower, I think was 50 cents or so. So it was, I do that once because 50 cents is halfway towards my next trip to the fair. But I'd say probably 95% of the fair was free once you got inside.
Yeah, that's not bad.
No, it was a real bargain for a dollar.
Yeah. Yeah. Do they still even conduct the World's Fair? Is that something that's still even done?
Yeah. It's funny. That question comes up a lot. The next World's Fair is actually this year in Milan. I'm trying to convince myself I want to go over and stand in line and, you know, go and play with that. But there's quite a few World's Fairs. I mean, after the 64 World's Fair, we had three more of them here in the United States. And then the last one in the United States was 1984 in New Orleans. And the last one in North America was 1986 in Vancouver. And they were great, but the United States government refuses to pay for World's Fairs, and they dropped out of the licensing body, so there's none anywhere remotely on the horizon for the U.S. for the future.
That's a shame. I do remember, I remember going to, I guess it was Vancouver. I remember our family going to Canada, so it might have been Vancouver.
We had Expo 67 up in Montreal.
That's where we were.
Oh, the Great World Fair, one of my favorites as well. And that ended up running for almost 10 years, or actually parts of it. It lasted all the way up to 1980. It would get smaller over time, but they kept reopening the pavilions. And what would be the Japan Pavilion one year might be Czechoslovakia the next year. But that was basically a World's Fair that was so successful that was planned for 6 months. And it ran for parts of it for 13, 14 years.
Wow. You know, the one thing I do remember from that World's Fair, which is kind of crazy, is I think we spent the better part of like 3 hours trying to find a place to eat. Because it was either like French food or German food. And we were all young kids at the time. And my father's like, can't I just get a hamburger? So
yeah, they had it in various places. You had to go find it. It was funny because Expo 86 in Vancouver, McDonald's got the license to be the official hamburger of the World's Fair, and you couldn't get a hamburger except at McDonald's. So other people started getting smart and saying, "Oh, would you like a Salisbury steak?" Or, you know, it's coming up with other names for it. But that's one of the things I liked about World's Fairs. I've been fortunate that I've gone to quite a few of them, and like to go and, you know, try things you would never find in, you know, the food court at your local mall. There's sometimes I don't even know what it was I ate. Maybe it's better that I don't, but it's been a fun way to, you know, try things.
Right. Now, I was reading online that there were rumors that Disney was actually going to stay in Flushing with their attractions and call it like as an East Coast Disneyland.
Yeah, there's people keep bringing that up, and there's really no validity to that particular rumor. The whole issue with doing a fair in the East Coast is that you can only do it for a small portion of the year because the weather is so bad otherwise. Did you ever hear of a park called Freedomland?
No.
Freedomland was a theme park in the Bronx section of New York, and it was built in large part by a guy named C.V. Wood, who is one of the original architects and builders out of Disneyland. And I worked with C.V. later on a theme park project for Germany, and I talked to him about Freedomland. I asked him, you know, hey, can I talk to you about Freedomland? And he said, oh, God, you're not one of my, debtors, are you? You know, do I owe you money? And what happened with Freedomland is they came back and they built this wonderful theme park. It was really just super. And they found out that, you know, between May and September, you can operate. The rest of the year, it's closed. The weather just is not conducive for people going out to, any sort of experience like that. As he also said, the New York unions were far worse than they ever anticipated. And Disney had the same thing, that to get maintenance work done at the World's Fair was incredibly expensive because of the unions. So he had actually been approached by some people to take over the World's Fair for the 65 season and chuck out Robert Moses, the head of the fair. And Walt just saw the politics that were going on with New York City politics and everything else. I think he was glad to get out of the fair. Literally, the day the fair ended, the next day, the boats were on trucks heading for California for Small World. They didn't waste any time getting out of there. Wow. And he was, of course, already, you know, by that point in time, it hadn't been announced to the public, but he was well under his planning and considerations for you know, the Florida project.
Yeah, interesting. It's amazing how many rumors and myths and folklores come out of these things.
It is, and it's, as I mentioned earlier, it's sometimes you have to gently debunk people's you know, theories and that sort of thing. But I've been fortunate that, you know, I continue to freelance for Disney, and I've gone through the World's Fair files extensively at the Disney archives, and I've also gone through the ones at Ford and some of the other companies that participated. And it's very interesting to see the difference between what's written down in paper and in contracts as opposed to the, you know, the stories that that people will tell you.
Yeah. I know one thing you mentioned at the D23 Rewind event was your extensive photos of the World's Fair. Can you tell us a little bit about your photo collection?
Yeah, I had an uncle. My uncle Steve was a big photography nut, and I was very, very fortunate that he would give me his hand-me-downs. I think it was his way of telling my Aunt Gertrude, you know, why he had to buy another camera so he could give Bill his old one. But he encouraged my my budding love of photography, and I took as many pictures as I could afford. And again, thank God Uncle Steve would help me out, giving me roll of film here or there, teach me how to develop film. So I took a bunch of pictures and put them away and really didn't think much about them. Flash forward, you know, I ended up then working for Disney, and I still had, you know, good thoughts about the fair. But 1987, I was working for Warner Brothers at the time, and I was back in New York on a business trip. And I took the train out to Flushing Meadows and walked through there and shot a whole bunch of pictures of, you know, what was left there at the time. And it just started me thinking about, no, the World's Fair. I mean, you know, kind of looked at my old pictures, took those out, you know, lamented on how bad a photographer I was, and I still think I'm still bad, but I started putting ads in papers and that to, like, you know, would you like to sell me your old pictures of the World's Fair? And going to auctions and, you know, flea markets, and then, you know, eBay comes along, and I've just been buying and buying and buying. And if I tell you how many pictures I have, I hope you don't have me committed. You promise not to have me locked away?
I promise.
We won't.
from the 64 World's Fair alone, I have about 24,000.
Wow.
Yeah, and then, of course, I had to expand and go off to all the other World's Fairs and everything. So I have somewhere in the vicinity of about 70,000 photos from World's Fairs now.
Incredible.
I recall that a historian of the expos. I mean, that's... Oh,
most people just call it a nutcase, but thank you for being kind.
No.
I really get a kick out of them. You know, like, I just posted a picture on Facebook the other day of, you know, something that it's just, to most people, they go, why on earth would you somebody have taken a picture of that? And it was the end of the 64 season, and they had so many guidebooks from the fair because they had overestimated how many people were coming. It was basically like, buy one and take as many as you want sort of thing. So people out there at the gate of the fair just stacked up with cases of these things. And that's the sort of thing I get a kick out of, you know, just seeing the little bits of things that made the whole fair a human-sized experience, the candid pictures that people took, as opposed to all the publicity shots of what people wanted you to see. And that's what I based, I've done 8 books now on World's Fairs, and that's what I've based them on, is all the candid pictures that, you know, people like me, or, you know, if you had been there yourselves, things you might have found of interest.
So interesting. Yeah, so with that in mind, can you share with everybody, like, how they can find you online?
Yeah, really easy. You can look for worldsfairphotos.com. And I've tried to put something down there for most of the World's Fairs that I've been to, or some of the ones that I was too young for. And sometime I got to update it with, I hope if I get over to Milan, I'll try to update it with that. But it's worldsfairphotos.com. Or if you just remember my name, billcotter.com, that has stuff about some of my other Disney things like Zorro and some of the books and stuff I've written, and that will get you over to the World's Fair section.
Unbelievable. So yep. Comprehensive. Both of these sites are just amazing. Just represent so many hours of work. You must really love this.
Yeah, I did. Plus, I retired about 2.5 years ago, and before that, I had a pretty high-stress job. I was in the information technology field, and you know, all day long, I'd be worrying about budgets and schedules, and you know, hiring people, firing people, and all that sort of stuff. And I'd come home at night, and the photos were a real release valve because I'd sit there with a picture, and it's got a big scratch across it. And how am I going to get that scratch off? And how, you know, what tool am I going to use? And how am I going to bring the colors back? And you know, 15, 20 minutes later, I finish the picture, and I haven't even thought about work once in that period of time. And it just became a real, you know, way to just leave the, you know, the pressures of the job behind. And then it also is a great way. I met a lot of great people. I like to joke about my wife being very understanding, which she is. But I met her on a soundstage at Disney, and I keep thinking if I hadn't gone to the World's Fair at 12 and gotten captivated, and then if I hadn't walked through the gate of Disney World and been, you know, just blinded, you know, by the, you know, the beauty of that and run off and buy a tie. And the next thing I'm working for California, and now I'm married for somebody from Disney and two kids. You know, it's funny how your life just bounces around with things like that.
Yeah.
Very true. Very true.
Yes. Yeah, well, go ahead.
No, sorry.
The
stage is yours.
No, really, it's yours. Go ahead and share what you were going to say. I was just going to wrap up, but if we have more, we should say more. So go ahead.
No, I just, one of the things I really enjoy, is hearing from people that have gone to the World's Fair and, they go to things like my site or Facebook, or we have another discussion group that any of your listeners are welcome to. It's worldsfaircommunity.org. And it's a real pleasure to me when people post something and they say, like, oh, I think I remember some pavilion where so and such happened, and I'm able to pop a picture out and say, any chance this is what you were talking about? And you get back, oh my God, you know, that's what I was. I haven't seen that since I was 12 or 13 years old. And what's really fun is so far five people have found themselves in the pictures that I have in the collection.
Whoa.
Four people at the World's Fair and one person at Disneyland. And, somebody was saying, you know, well, we had the pictures and we lost them in a move. You know, I know this is a long shot, but by any chance do you have pictures of the World's Fair, the one day I was there, June 2nd, 1964. And, oh, yeah, I do. And, you know, I post him, a guy goes, oh my God, that's my mother, my brother, that's me. You know, it's just really a kick when you can help people recapture their prized memories again. That to me is the fun part.
Yeah. Back, I'm going to say in the 90s maybe, Microsoft had some photo software where, let's say you went to, Disney World or Disneyland, and you took a whole bunch of photos, they would be able to map them on a map and reconstruct how those photos would be. Like, if you had enough photos, you could actually reconstruct Disneyland or Disney World. It'd be interesting if that software is still in existence, Bill, and if you could take your World's Fair photos and upload them and, like, recreate the World's Fair in a 3D kind of walkthrough effect. That's what the purpose of the software was, that you'd actually then be able to
Yeah, I remember that. I remember seeing that. Well, yeah. We've done something sort of like that, or you probably have heard about the new Disney movie Tomorrowland.
Yes, yes.
That's the one with George Clooney. Mm-hmm. I supplied all the photos to Disney for that and helped them recreate the World's Fair. I had previously done that for and two, helping them rebuild the fictitious Stark Expo. But for Tomorrowland, it was an absolute kick to work on that, because they have gone to some incredible details. I mean, they would call me up and really want to know, was the color of the Greyhound bus driver's tie the same as the ribbons that the gals who worked in the Greyhound information stands wore? Now, I know that the bus drivers had an orange tie and the gals wore yellow. Okay, and which side of the small world did they wear the lapel pins? Was it the left or the right? So a lot of this stuff will never, ever really show in the detail of the film. But I tell you, I'm really impressed by what the level of detail they went to recreating things like souvenir stands to be 100% authentic of what would be sold in a stand. I mean, we had a lot of discussions about it. So I'm really looking forward to seeing more of the movie to see how it all came out. But there's also there's a woman in Florida, Dr. Lori Walters. Have you heard about her recreation of the fair?
No.
No.
Oh, it's called Chrono Leap, C-H-R-O-N-O Leap, and I don't have the URL in front of me. But Lori's over at the University of Central Florida, and she wanted to teach kids how to do 3D modeling. But she said, you know, what's the joy of doing a shopping center or, you know, a generic building? So she had them recreate the World's Fair, and it's a great interactive event where you go back to the Queen's Museum of today, and you discover a way to go back to the World's Fair of 64. And they used original audio recording, so as you go down the street, you'll hear the sound. As you go past the African Pavilion, you'd hear the actual sounds of that. You get over to General Electric, you'd hear the actual sounds of the music they were playing on the street, things like that. And then it's an educational thing because you run around this virtual World's Fair trying to, you know, solve a mystery that you get from various clues of, you know, what was in this pavilion, what was introduced here. Go look it up, Chrono Leap. It's absolutely a fascinating thing. And the students in UCF are doing an amazing job. They would take like a still photograph I would have of, say, the Grand Central Parkway. But they would make the cars look like they were moving in it by just digitally moving, you know, this car a couple pixels. So when you watch it, all of a sudden, this static picture that I know is static because it's my picture, I'm watching, and the cars are driving down the road, and the planes are flying by. They did a just, I mean, I'm a computer geek myself. I'm real impressed by what they did.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
You can go download it and spend hours. I'll warn you, it's addictive.
All right, maybe I need to not download that.
It's really neat. I'm looking at it here, but yeah, if you just type in Chrono Leap in Google, it pops up on the top. The actual URL is pretty complicated, but we'll put a link in the show notes so everybody can check it out and spend lots of time looking at this. This is fun.
Yeah, it was fun. You know, there was a fellow named Ray Dashner, and Ray had taken a audio reel-to-reel recorder and carried it all around the fair, and you know, that's where a lot of this background music came from. And then on eBay, I saw an auction listing for the original music that they played over the PA systems and the fireworks show and that. So we all donated this stuff to Dr. Walter's team, and they were able to, again, you know, not just have a sound of somebody saying something, but, you know, the real audio from 1964. It's pretty amazing that, you know, somebody had saved it all those years.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah, I'm excited about the movie. So I don't know if you guys heard, I think they just said this like a couple days ago, but they're actually going to be showing like like sort of a preview of Tomorrowland in Epcot beginning in mid-April in the Imagination Pavilion. They're going to put it in the Imagination Theater, whatever that is. I can't think of what that is right now. But
well, that should be where, what you call it, the Michael Jackson, the Captain EO movie had been,
yes.
And before that, the Making Memories film.
Yep. Oh, okay. So that I guess they'll be putting that in there instead of Captain EO. So,
yeah. Oh, it's tough for me I had to, you know, sign a non-disclosure and not tell people, and people would say, "Oh, I hear about this movie. Oh, really? Oh, okay." You know, and. But it was funny because when they first called me up to work on it, it was called Project Tesla, and big Hollywood secrecy. And, you know, they were paying me for the pictures, and, you know, literally, they'd come out to the house and pay me in cash and that. But one day the woman called and said, "Oh, we're running a little late. You know, could you call me back and let me know if, you know, if you're still going to be there?" So I called her back, and, you know, they answered Project Tesla, and I said, yeah, I'm going to be here. But I said, you know, if it's getting late in the day, I'm going to be at the studio tomorrow, and, you know, I can drop off the pictures then. She goes, I didn't tell you what studio this is. And I said, well, it's Disney. She goes, what makes you think it's Disney? And I said, well, it starts with 818-560. All those numbers are Disney. And she was like, oh, my God. Then they switched to calling people on cell phones. So. Yeah, I said, you're probably sitting in my old building, which she was. I used to be in the animation building, and that's where they were. So, it's you know, no pun intended, it is a small world.
Gosh, that's great.
That's so great. Cool.
Well, I hope that is of interest to you and your listeners.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. This has been so fascinating. Oh, my goodness. So, and just the timing is wonderful with the new movie coming out soon and everything. Everybody's really going to enjoy it. So thank you, Bill, for your time. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Like I said, it was a major, major milestone in my life. And, you know, if any of your listeners, you know, go off to my site, I have pictures of every pavilion that they can look at for free, and they can download, you know, the original audio from the fair. They can go off and look at movies, and, you know, just tell them to go and have a good time, and I hope they feel 12 again.
Yeah, we definitely will.
Absolutely. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Make sure you check all that out, and we'll see you in the parks.
The Disney Parks Podcast is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company. All Disney parks, attractions, lands, shows, event names, etc. are registered trademarks of the Walt Disney Company.
Like a moon out of the blue, fate steps in and sees you through.